From the studios of snowy KPCW in Park City, Utah, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our first guest this morning, Martin Ford. He's the author of Rule of the Robots, How Artificial Intelligence Will Transform Everything. Now, Ford's previous book on the future of AI and work, Rise of the Robots, in 2015, won the Financial Times Business Book of the Year Award. And you're not going to want to miss this next conversation as Ford presents a striking vision of a near future where artificial intelligence has become as commonplace as electricity, invading even the areas we consider most human.
We look forward to that conversation. Our second guest this morning is National Geographic explorer and photographer Thomas Pezschak. He joins us to talk about his new book, Wild Seas. Now, this book contains over 200 remarkable images from wild ocean locales around the globe, including his celebrated photo of a great white shark closely following a marine biologist in a kayak.
Our guest is Martin Ford. He's the author of Rule of the Robots, How Artificial Intelligence Will Transform Everything. Ford presents a striking vision of a near future where artificial intelligence has become as commonplace and ubiquitous as electricity, invading even the areas we consider most human. And drawing on conversations with leaders in the field of AI, including DeepMind CEO Dennis Hassabis, Ford explores how AI can alter our lives for the better, along with its dark side, and what might be done to mitigate its potential harm. Martin Ford, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
We are delighted to have you. This is a book that has really grabbed a lot of buzz, and of course it's on the heels of your 2015 Rise of the Robots. It's a fascinating book. Maybe you can start, Martin, by telling us how you organize this book in chapters.
Well, the overriding theme of the book, again, is that artificial intelligence is really going to become ubiquitous, like electricity. It's going to be transformative. So the way I approached that was to essentially begin with that argument, explaining why it is becoming a systemic technology and how that's happening, how, for example, cloud computing is making that possible. And then I talk a bit about the future of artificial intelligence and how it's evolving. And how it's, most importantly, how it's going to evolve in the future and how it's going to get ever closer to what we call artificial general intelligence or human level intelligence, which is kind of the holy grail of the field to actually build a machine that can truly think. So I've got a couple of chapters that really delve into that, and that's where I draw on conversations with some of the really smartest people in the world, you know, to discuss that. I talk then about the practical applications of AI and which areas we're going to see progress relatively fast and which areas it might take longer and which areas are kind of overhyped. So, for example, I talk about self-driving cars and how the progress there is really not quite met expectations. You know, we've been hearing about that for many years, but it's proven to be very, very difficult to build, for example, cars that can drive themselves. So I discussed that and also areas where we are going to see, you know, very rapid advance. And then finally in the book, I look at a number of dangers or concerns that are going to come along with AI, including the potential for jobs to be automated, for there to be a big impact on the job market and potential increased inequality. That was really the subject of my earlier book, Rise of the Robots. And then there are a number of other issues. You know, we've seen racial bias in algorithms. There are security threats. There's the specter of what are called deep fakes or algorithms that can be used to fabricate media that could deceive us. There's the potential for weaponization of artificial intelligence, you know, the building of fully autonomous weapons. And then there's, you know, much further out there, the speculative fear of a truly existential threat from superintelligence. So I've got a number of chapters to go through all of those issues. So it's really quite a broad take on artificial intelligence and what it means for the future.
And it's certainly well balanced. It's not just a dystopic view that the robots are coming for us, and it's also not a perfectly positive view. I mean, you provide a balanced examination, and maybe we can start with the historic DeepMind announcement on November 30th, 2020, about its ability to do what man has been working on for over 50 years and just has not been able to do. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so DeepMind announced, as you say, late last year, that they had built a system called AlphaFold version 2 that can essentially solve what's called the protein folding problem. Now, protein molecules are, of course, the building blocks of life. They, you know, most of the structures in our body are protein, and even more importantly, most of the functions within our body are carried out by protein molecules. They're really kind of the basic fabric of life. Now, protein molecules are fabricated in the cell based on a genetic recipe, and that's been well understood for a long time, but what happens is once the protein molecule is fabricated, it instantly folds up into a particular three-dimensional shape. And it's that shape of this very complex molecule that actually determines its function. You know, molecular interactions are a little bit like Legos, the way the molecules interact together. So the shape of the molecule is really critical to understanding the way it works. And of course, we've got a very clear example of that with the coronavirus spike protein, right, which is, you know, shaped in a way that allows it to essentially attach to our cells. And this is true of all protein molecules. So for a very long time, scientists have wanted to have a technique that would allow them to, you know, given the genetic recipe that specifies the amino acids that are in the protein molecule, how can they determine the shape of the molecule based on how it's going to fold up? And they can do this with very time-consuming and a very expensive laboratory techniques, but there hasn't been a way to figure that out based on, you know, the genetic code of the protein molecule. And scientists have been working on this for something like 50 years, and just within, you know, 2 years of beginning this project, AlphaFold, DeepMind's system was able to basically solve this problem. I mean, it's considered to basically be a revolution in science. And as a result of that, DeepMind is now, you know, determining the shapes of virtually every protein molecule that is important to human beings and also to other organisms. So they're creating this huge library of the way protein molecules are configured, and that's going to be of enormous value to the future of medicine. These techniques have already been used, for example, to help develop treatments for the coronavirus. So this is something, you know, really one of the biggest moments in science in terms of solving this problem. And it's really, you know, one of the first really big real-world uses of artificial intelligence. You know, previously we've seen DeepMind create AlphaGo and win at games and things like this. But this is a really an important application to the field of science that's really going to have, I think, revolutionary benefits going forward.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Martin Ford. He's the author of Rule of the Robots. It's a new book. He's also the author of Rise of the Robots, The Lights in the Tunnel, and Architects of Intelligence. Martin, you have really followed, I mean, what you've just been talking about is incredible, looking at how AI is creating this incredible, you know, ability to create a future for medicine that's positive. And yet for years, you know, for well over a decade, you've been talking about this human aspect of AI and your concerns about how it is creating more inequity. I mean, we know already that so many jobs have become automated. And you talk about how if all of our jobs become automated, not only does it increase inequity, but it really is a huge, it will hugely and negatively impact our economy. Can you go into that a little bit?
Right. So that's sort of the issue that I've really been focused on focusing on the most for years. And the reality is that AI gets better, virtually any job that is fundamentally predictable, the kind of job where you come to work and you do basically the same kinds of things or take on the same challenges. I mean, it doesn't have to be rote repetitive like standing on an assembly line, but just, you know, doing things that are more routine and predictable. All of that is going to be susceptible to automation. And it might be a robot if you're, you know, if it's more of a blue-collar manual job where you're manipulating the world. Or it could be, you know, a white-collar job where you're sitting in front of a computer doing something that's relatively routine. In fact, those jobs could be even easier to automate. So I think that over the next 10 years, we're definitely going to see a big impact, and it's going to continue beyond that. So a lot of jobs are going to disappear. Of course, there will be new jobs created, but it's unclear that there will be enough of those, you know, to match up with all the jobs that are lost. And also, there'll be entirely different jobs that require different skill sets, maybe, you know, more technical training or different personality traits, like the ability to work with people and so forth. So there's a real risk, I think, that a lot of people are going to be left behind. They won't be able to transition into these new jobs. And that, as you say, could definitely lead to more inequality. It could lead to potential unemployment or underemployment. Certain segments of our population really not, you know, being able to generate a reasonable income by working. And that, in turn, directly impacts the economy because, of course, if people aren't working, then they don't have incomes, and then they can't go out and purchase the products and services being produced. So, you know, you run into a situation where it kind of undermines demand in the economy. It undermines the ability of the economy to thrive. So it's not just a social issue where, you know, people can't find jobs. It certainly is that, but it's also an economic issue.
You know, Moore's Law says that our technology, the potential and the speed of technology will double every 2 years. And so it's growing and it's doubling and it's, you know, growing exponentially. However, you know, going back to this human aspect, that while our jobs become automated and we lose certain jobs, we should look at the opportunity to grow creatively and create new jobs and find ways to put people into other, you know, better sorts of situations that get them away from maybe jobs that are dangerous and dirty and all of that. And yet that we don't have Moore's Law that applies to human solutions, right? And so it seems to me that there is just a big, you know, while technology advances, the human aspect isn't advancing as quickly. What can we do about that?
Well, we definitely need to put more emphasis on programs to help people transition. I think that, you know, a lot of, as I said, more routine jobs are going to disappear, but the jobs that are less likely to be threatened are, for example, jobs that are more creative or jobs that involve working very closely with people and building relationships, because, of course, machines are not yet good at that. Or jobs that really require lots of dexterity and mobility, like an electrician or a plumber. You know, it would take a science fiction level robot to do what an electrician does, for example. So those are the kinds of jobs that are likely to be there in the future. So we definitely need programs that help people transition into that newly available work. And, you know, I think that would mean investing more in community colleges, for example, that allow people to educate themselves. But still, I think in the long run, it could eventually be such a problem that even programs of that won't be sufficient. And that's why, for example, I've also advocated for someday having something like a universal basic income to actually supplement people's incomes so that, you know, they even if people are not able to find work that generates a sufficient income for them and their family, they can still, you know, have access to basic living standards.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Martin Ford. He's written Rule of the Robots, How Artificial Intelligence Will Transform Everything. Martin, we love to talk about the adoption rate of technology on Cool Science Radio, and you point out in your book that in 1752, Ben Franklin had his famous kite experiment on electricity. It was 127 years later, Thomas Edison perfected the incandescent light bulb, and 40 years later, only a half of the United States had access to electric power, and then another 30 years on top of that before electricity really evolved into the ubiquitous utility that it is today. Rather than talk about something that might happen 50 or 60 years in the future, I love what you pointed out in the book about something that could happen 10 years from now. So today, hundreds of thousands of people work side by side with robots in Amazon distribution centers. And the humans are there because the robots don't have the human hand dexterity thing going for them yet. But there's at least three companies, including Amazon, that are working on the dexterity issue. Is it possible, and maybe you can talk about this a bit, that those hundreds of thousands of employees may have to be looking for some new work in the near future?
Yeah, I think that's probably almost inevitable. I mean, there's no question that there's a lot of resources being put into building robots that can do the things that the employees, the workers, are now there to do in those warehouses. And mostly that involves what's called stowing and picking. In other words, they take inventory and they put it on a shelf, or they either retrieve inventory from a shelf to send it to a customer. And you know, the robots are not yet at the point where they can do that, because you've got to deal with, you know, many different shapes and sizes and weights and textures of products. But probably within about 10 years, we're going to get to the point where robots can do, you know, all of that, or at least a lot of it. So over that period of time, we're going to see those warehouses become more and more automated. In fact, Jeff Bezos said a couple of years ago that he thought it would be about 10 years until we had robotic grasping, you know, robotic hands that could essentially match human dexterity. So I think that's kind of inevitable. So that's, you know, obviously Amazon warehouses and similar environments have been kind of an employment bright spot. Lots of jobs have been created there. In some instances, it's been sort of a transition from traditional retail jobs that have been lost into these warehouse jobs. But those jobs are definitely not guaranteed to stick around forever. So we could see a lot of those disappear. And of course, it's not just going to be Amazon warehouses. There's going to be fast food restaurants and supermarkets and other commercial settings. You know, these robots, as they become more dexterous and capable, are going to be deployed in many, many different settings.
And for those folks that are concerned about an Orwellian future sometime in the future, maybe happening now or starting to happen with facial recognition and surveillance in the country of China. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so China is really the world leader in, you know, deploying these technologies like facial recognition, but other forms of surveillance as well, in you know, a very dystopian Orwellian way. They really are building, you know, this sort of overseeing Orwellian state that is literally going to watch everyone in the country eventually and track even the smallest actions to make sure that people are doing what the government wants them to do, basically. And that is something that is not limited to China. I mean, they're exporting that technology, especially to other authoritarian states, like in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, and so forth. And we're definitely beginning to see that intrude in the West as well. So I think every country is going to have to, you know, the populations are going to have to look at these technologies and make a trade-off there. It is clear that having facial recognition can reduce crime. It can protect us against, you know, terrorism, for example. So it does clearly have benefits, but at the same time, it runs the risk of really causing our privacy to basically evaporate. And that's a conversation that I think every country, every jurisdiction is going to become very important, you know, and people are going to have to decide what they want to make, what they want to do with this trade-off in terms of privacy versus security.
Martin, can you talk about some of the other ways that this AI that China is so on the forefront of using is infiltrating our lives? I heard some crazy, story the other day about, like, when you go on Facebook and how many fake, you know, how much deep fake there is there in terms of entire accounts that are, you know, just Chinese but posing as You know, maybe it's a Christian evangelical site, but it's not what it appears to be. How much of this are we encountering on a day-by-day basis?
Right. I mean, deep fakes are going to become a very, very important issue going forward. And that's not specific to China. This is technology using artificial intelligence that can create fake media. Basically, you can go online, and if you Google deep fake photographs or deep fake faces, you will see these incredibly, you know, genuine looking photographs of people who actually do not exist. These are photographs that look absolutely realistic. You would never guess that this is not a real person, but this person was just fabricated. And there's no one, you know, on the planet Earth that actually looks exactly like what you're seeing there, even though it looks like a completely accurate photo. And more importantly, this technology can be used to create fake video, fake audio. So we're really moving into a world where you're going to start seeing things and hearing things that simply are not true, that are simply made up. And I give an example, for example, in the book of how an audio track of a politician saying something very damaging, you know, something criminal, something racist, whatever, right before an election, for example, could be, you know, put out there. It could go viral and it could actually tip an election, right? If someone created a really malicious soundtrack, you know, something that purported to be a recording of a phone call or something, of someone saying something. There have actually been instances already when deepfakes have been used to build companies out of millions of dollars by fabricating audio of the CEO during a phone call, calling up the finance department and telling them to wire money to a specific account. And this has actually been done a couple of times just by creating fake audio of the CEO speaking based on, you know, other recordings or interviews that the CEO has done. It's basically a machine learning process where if there's data out there of how someone speaks, you can train one of these algorithms to create a fabricated version. So this is something, you know, potentially it's going to be very disruptive in the years ahead. You can imagine in a court case, you know, that the evidence you're seeing and hearing could potentially be fabricated. You know, how are we going to deal with that as a society?
It seems to me, Martin, that as our technology advances, that we would also be able to come up with something that can out a deep fake so that our democracy, for example, cannot be destroyed.
Yeah, I mean, there are companies working on that, but, you know, anytime when technology advances like this, there's always a kind of an arms race between the people that are using it for mischievous purposes and the people that are trying to defend against it. And this is what you see, for example, with computer viruses, right? There's always new computer viruses, and then you've got the companies that make antivirus software that are trying to keep up with that. And you're going to see something similar with deepfakes. But the people that best understand this technology have said that ultimately, you know, it may not be possible to have a reliable technological way to know if it's really a deep fake or if it's real. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it's just pixels, right? If it's a photograph, it's just ones and zeros out there, and it's not necessarily going to always be possible to know what is real and what's not. So we may eventually have to find a way to live in that kind of a world.
Well, people are so involved with or so affected by confirmation bias that they will believe what they want to believe. So I think the perception is always going to trump reality in this new world. So that's going to add another level of confusion to all of this, I think.
Yeah, I think we've already certainly seen evidence of that. You know, people clearly will believe things that are simply not true, and there seems to be very little we can do about that. You know, you see this around vaccine hesitancy and so forth right now. I think it's going to be an increasing problem that we're going to have to find a way to navigate around in the future.
Well, Park City can be called Tesla City in a way. I mean, there's a lot of Teslas running around here. A lot of our listeners are interested in autonomous vehicles, the promise of autonomous vehicles. You know, 5 years ago, we should have had them, according to what they were saying at the time. Can you level set our expectations for us?
Well, it is just that building a self-driving car that's going to operate on public roads is an extraordinarily difficult challenge. Now, I talked earlier about Amazon warehouses and how, you know, we're going to see potential rapid progress there and a lot of jobs could disappear. The difference between an Amazon warehouse and, of course, the road, you know, a public road, is that an Amazon warehouse is a very controlled environment. So Amazon has enormous control over everything that happens in that warehouse. They can keep the robots away from the people to make sure, you know, accidents don't happen and so forth. Out on a public road in the real environment, you know, it's completely unpredictable. Anything can happen. You have to, you know, and what's happening with self-driving cars is that we already have, you know, cars that can drive reliably in most situations, most normal situations. Where they run into trouble is when the unusual, unpredictable things happen. And the reality is that you could have a self-driving car that's 99% perfect, but that last 1% is going to, you know, make it worse than not having it, because, if you multiply that by thousands and thousands of cars on the road, you're going to have incidents all the time. So, a self-driving car has got to be virtually perfect. Yeah. And this is the problem that Tesla's running into. Elon has been promising that he's going to do this cool self-driving feature for a while now, and yet it's proving to be a real challenge. I think Tesla is definitely one of the leading companies doing this, and I respect what they're doing, but I do think that certainly Elon has overpromised in terms of this technology, and it's a bit dangerous. You are seeing accidents as a result of this technology being out there. I mean, he's kind of using his customers to beta test this technology on public roads, and I think that that's a very dangerous thing to do.
Yeah. Oh, Martin Ford has written Rule of the Robots, How Artificial Intelligence Will Transform Everything. You know, Martin, we could talk to you the rest of the morning and probably most of the afternoon. We hope you'll come back and join us. This is an important book and a fascinating subject. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Martin.
Our guest is Thomas Peschak, who is a National Geographic photographer. His new book, Wild Seas, is a collection of 200 images and the stories behind them from around the globe. In South Africa, Peschak photographs epic underwater battles of ravenous sharks feasting on sardines. Off Baja California, he comes face to face with playful whales. And in the Antarctic, he treks across remote volcanoes in pursuit of penguins. He reveals the backstory behind his celebrated photo of a great white shark closely following a marine biologist in a kayak, and dodges saltwater crocs to get the perfect shot of nesting sea turtles in Australia. Thomas Peschak, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. Much appreciated. Lovely to talk to both of you.
Well, you know, I find that with you, Thomas, in your book, it's almost as much about the story as it is about the photograph. You're a great storyteller. Talk a little bit about that and how much it is about the story when you're taking that photograph.
You know, I've been a National Geographic photographer now for 15 years, and I've probably made more than a million photographs in that time, more than a million. And for this book, I really had to scour and dig through my archives and select only 200 images. And yes, on the one hand, they're my favorite. Most importantly, each of those 200 images tells a story, because that's, you know, I'm not that interested in beautiful imagery, and I'm interested in beautiful images that actually have something to say. And these are images that I've made on dozens of challenging expeditions to some of the planet's wildest and most remote coastlines. And each of the photograph tells a story of a unique animal, be it, you know, the behavior of a great white shark, or an aggregation of manta rays, or marine iguanas, you know, feeding on algae, or common dolphins. And they also tell the stories of pristine places like the Galapagos, or the Seychelles, or Antarctic islands. And together, you know, each of these images tells their own story, but together, collectively, they really tell the story of our planet's rich yet oh so fragile marine realm. But the book does more than that. And the pictures, they also really tell my own personal story. from this, 10-year-old nerdy fish obsessed kid who wanted to be a marine biologist, who then became a marine biologist. I mean, working on kelp forest and sharks, and then later making this leap to becoming a National Geographic photographer and explorer. So it's all about story, and the book really, I think, reveals what is life like, on assignment for National Geographic, the highs and the lows, warts and all, the agony and ecstasy. I mean, what does it take to travel to the edge of the world again and again and come back with these iconic photographs that you see, be it in my book or be it in the magazine or on our Instagram feed? It's all about, telling stories that inspire and that get people to think and to act and to hopefully ultimately change their ways.
Yeah. Well, I love the quote that you sort of start the book out with, which is, you can't fall in love with something you don't know exists. As a photographer, I am a matchmaker. I introduce people to wildlife that lies hidden beneath the ocean's surface. This is so important, for us to, if we don't know what is beneath the ocean surfaces, we might not want to protect or conserve it. So talk about that education of people.
As it really is as, simplistic, but also as profound as you said, you can't fall in love with something you don't know. And as a National Geographic photographer, who specializes in oceans and coastlines and remote areas, remote wildernesses, I dive beneath that reflective, mirrored ocean surface, and I reveal this alien but incredibly fascinating realm. And I need to inspire people. And I do that by showing them and telling them stories about these pristine marine habitats and showcase these magical creatures. And hopefully they fall in love. And hopefully they go, wow, I cannot believe that a place as beautiful as this really exists on our planet. But of course, as a photojournalist, I need to also reflect the truth. And I also have to show that darker side of our relationship with the ocean. And that, of course, includes, the impact of pollution and climate change and overfishing. And I feel like I walk this incredibly fine line between the carrot and the stick, between inspiring and disturbing with photographs. And too much beauty, I feel, results in complacency, while too much gore and death leads to hopelessness. So I try my best to make photographs that tell a balanced story and that get people to think, act, and fall in love. And ultimately, I want them to make a difference themselves and become part of the solution rather than actually remaining part of the problem, if that makes any sense.
It certainly does. Thomas Peschak is a National Geographic photographer. His new book, Wild Seas, is a collection of 200 images and the stories behind them from around the globe. And Thomas, I've looked at a lot of photography books. There's something very special about these 200 photographs. I mean, they are just spectacular. And to continue on with what Lynn was asking you about, James Cameron takes it to the next level. He says, if you love something, you will take care of it. And that's what we're trying to do, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The helping to protect the ocean is not this exclusive domain of a few National Geographic photographers or biologists or filmmakers or conservationists. It is, in fact, the domain of everybody. It's everyone's responsibility, and it's within everyone's ability. I mean, I always say never, ever underestimate the power that an individual or a community has, but the first and biggest, first big step is to educate ourselves. And I think that in my case, I can do that, through photography and storytelling. And the really incredible thing is that once you've fallen in love with the ocean and its creatures, and once you are acutely aware of all the threats that are facing them, there are now so many opportunities to actually make a difference and get involved yourself. And that's where I think, my photography hopefully inspires. It raises awareness of the threat. But then I also want to, showcase and tell the stories of inspiring people who make a difference. And then most critically, give the reader and my audience a way to get involved themselves so that they can feel part of the solution. And you know, whether it is volunteering your services to a local conservation group that protects, you know, endangered sea turtles, or whether you donate to a grassroots organization that, you know, helps protect coral reefs, or, you know, if you're passionate about the ocean as an individual, no matter where you are, and whether you're a radio host, a poet, a photographer, a writer, whatever you might, you know, share that enthusiasm and love with as many people as possible. I mean, you know, tell those stories and become the eyes and ears for people not able to experience the marine realm firsthand. In an ideal world, I would like to take all of you, take every single person and actually take them on a dive or take them on the snorkel and actually get them face to face, get them to meet marine creatures. But that is, unfortunately, I don't have enough hands, number one. And number two, it's just completely impractical. So using photography and storytelling is the next best way to get people who might not have the experience that I have, who don't have the opportunity, you know, is to also get them to fall in love and to then make a difference. Because look, the two most significant threats to ocean health right now are overfishing and climate change. And to combat those requires really significant changes to our collective behavior as human beings. And this is where the individual is surprisingly powerful. You know, the consumer, you know, if you vote with your wallet, the food chain will follow. I mean, look at seafood. If you decide to eat fish and seafood, you go to a restaurant, you go to the supermarket, you know, your decision, what species you're willing to eat, you know, drives that business. And there's all these wonderful apps out there like Seafood Watch and others that are scientific. All you got to do is type in the name of the fish you want to eat, and it will tell you this is actually endangered, or this comes from a non-sustainable fishery, or this fishery actually destroys coral reefs. And you can make decisions if you educate yourself a little bit and you care enough. You can, because, you know, if you don't eat an endangered fish, if you don't eat fish from that fishery, the restaurant is not going to order it if no customer eats it. And the middleman won't abide from the fisherman. And if the fisherman can't sell it, well, he won't catch it. So at the end of the day, I think from an overfishing perspective, the consumer, the individual, has huge amounts of power. I think climate change is more complicated. I think as an individual, you can do a lot of things. You can reduce your carbon footprint. You can do so many things. But I think the biggest, single, most powerful thing you can do as an individual is to elect representatives and politicians who understand climate change, who have a decisive agenda to reduce CO2 emissions and who champion renewable energy. And I think the combination of grassroots individuals working together and electing representatives that actually know what they're doing, I think collectively, that is the only way we're going to ensure that all this wonderful marine life and all these beautiful ecosystems will survive for future generations to experience.
Thomas, Lynn and I have been doing Cool Science Radio for about 9.5 years now. And we've had the opportunity to meet a lot of our listeners because they communicate with us or we bump into them and, you know, that sort of thing. And as it turns out, not only are they curious lay people about science and technology, but there are a lot of them that are amateur photographers and some are even professional photographers. I had dinner with a friend last night who is an amateur wildlife photographer, and he had three questions he wanted me to ask you. Okay. And the first question is, what size lenses do you like to carry when you routinely shoot wildlife? The second question is, what time of the day do you like to shoot, sunrise versus midday? And well, if you're underwater, I guess it doesn't matter. And then the third question is, when you process your photos, what is the editing program that you like to use? So those come from a listener.
And these are great, great questions. And I will do my best to answer them as eloquently as I can. And I think, look, as far as the way I photograph underwater and above water is slightly different. And I do both. I work on coastal ecosystem, but let's just try to focus on the underwater for now. So underwater, I don't have the luxury to use long lenses. So if I'm on land, I'm in my Land Rover, I'm in the Serengeti, I'm in Southern Africa, I can use a fantastically long lens that weighs 3,000 kilos and I can, you know, and I can be 50 to 100 meters away from a line and I can make a really close-up fantastic image. Underwater, I can't use those lenses because the water simply robs you of clarity and robs you of light. So underwater, I can only use wide-angle lenses. And I have to use them to get my subject close. Almost all pictures underwater that I make, the subject, the animal that I'm photographing, is within a few feet of me. So it is very, very different. So wide angle lenses, you know, 15 millimeters, 16 millimeters, and I have to spend hours and sometimes days in the water with these animals to make them relaxed enough to allow me in their personal space. Because unlike on land, I can't observe from a distance. I can't sit in a high to hide. The animals know that I'm there, and they need to be comfortable enough with me to allow me in their space to be able to make these images with these wide angle lenses, where very often the animal is a foot away from me. So it's a very different way to shoot underwater as above water.
And Thomas, what editing program are you most comfortable with or gives you the type of tools and capabilities to get the product that you're looking for?
It's basically my camera, largely. I mean, at National Geographic, you know, we, you know, whether we photograph, you know, wildlife or social documentary or war, we're journalists, we're photojournalists first and foremost. And the goal is to capture the scene as accurately as humanly possible in camera. So at the end of the day, we do as little manipulation and editing as humanly possible. I mean, yes, you know, we might lighten things with lev a little bit, we might sharpen it, but at the end of the day, what I'm seeing on the back of the camera, the original raw file, is incredibly close to what you actually see published in the magazine. And that's largely because we want to try to, you know, capture the world as accurately as possible and, you know, do as little post-production as an actual fact. Every single photograph I make for National Geographic, I'm not allowed to delete anything. And the raw file without any manipulation goes to National Geographic for review. I cannot do anything except, you know, make the image and that's it. Everything beyond that is done there and it's done to very exacting rules and standards. So I don't spend much time, you know, with editing software at all, either for National Geographic or for personal work.
Mm, that's interesting. And then finally, time of day for underwater.
Well, it's interesting, you know, again, I mean, on land, of course, you know, most people, you know, limit themselves to morning and evening, which are, you know, incredible periods of beautiful light. You can also make powerful images in the middle of the day, as long as you're using artificial light and flashes. I think underwater, traditionally, most people, you know, they shoot during midday. And when the light is, when the sun is at its zenith at the highest point in the sky. But I also love shooting early and late. I love it when the light gets all moody. I mean, I can sometimes work up to an hour after sunset and the light becomes this almost purple, ethereal, you know, magical stuff. So again, I make photographs when the animals are, you know, behaving, you know, the way I want them to. I make the pictures when the natural world dictates that I have to make them. And if that coincides with beautiful light, sunset and sunrise, then that's wonderful. Otherwise, I need to make a plan to actually also make compelling and iconic images in conditions where maybe traditionally photographers wouldn't want to work because the light's considered harsh or not that pleasant.
Hmm. Thomas, of course, you're in South Africa now. You travel all over the world. We here in the American West can jump on a plane in about 3.5 hours, be in Cabo San Lucas in Baja California. In the spring, I was with my family. We were on a bit of a surf trip. So we were looking for surf. We just drove right on by Cabo Pulmo. I knew it was a marine reserve, but you really educated me on just exactly what went on there. Can you tell us the story of?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm what people consider an ocean optimist. I'm a realist as well. I mean, we are facing some real, real tough challenges, and the ocean and many parts of the ocean are becoming degraded. And I've seen in my own lifetime how ecosystems are degrading and how species are disappearing. But at the same time, I'm also constantly, you know, witnessing and bearing witness to the amazing resilience of the ocean, how if treated correctly and how, you know, if we implement conservation measures, how ecosystems from rocky reefs and coral reefs, they can recover remarkably quickly. And Cabo Pulmo is this little fishing village on the south, easternmost tip of Baja California. And, it's a fishing village, and it's a place with these offshore reefs. And you know, the fishermen there were noticing that their reefs were becoming depleted. They were catching less and less fish, and their catches were becoming meager, and fish were becoming smaller. And they decided to kind of take a stand, and they began to lobby the government to actually protect the waters in front of their village in these offshore reefs as a marine protected area. That was driven by the local fishing community themselves saying, look, this needs to change. And working with NGOs and scientists and conservationists, they managed to get this marine reserve proclaimed, the Kabupomo MPA. And what happened in the next 10 years was incredible. The fish biomass and the life just recovered at a rate that was unprecedented. And today, Kabupomo is literally considered by many the most successful marine reserve on this planet. And these reefs came back, and the fish came back from death's door to now being a place where people no longer fish, but most of the money is being made by tourists, by divers and snorkelers who come there to actually, you know, experience this healthy and vibrant rocky reef for themselves. And these fishermen now are making, you know, far more income than they've ever made from ecotourism than they have from fishermen. And of course, you know, you can only kill a fish once, but you can show a fish to a diver, I don't know, thousands of times over its lifetime. So that is a real story of hope and a story of like, you know, in an inspiring situation that you know, needs to be spoken more about to inspire other places like that to follow that route and to also, you know, combat against hopelessness and against people feeling defeated and thinking that, you know, what's the point? Why should I bother? You know, the oceans are done for anyway.
Yeah.
How can I make a difference? So I think Kabupomo and many other places I've seen where marine life has, look, it's not everywhere. It's a small percentage of the globe. This is not the norm. But the bottom line is, I think we need to really emphasize these positive stories to ensure that hope is not lost amongst this ocean of bad news that feels like it's hitting us, you know, on a daily basis.
That's right. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Thomas Peschak, who is a National Geographic photographer. His new book, Wild Seas, is a collection of 200 images and the stories behind them from around the globe. Thomas, we spoke earlier about it not being practical for you to take everybody in the planet underwater with you to look at these spectacular animals. But the promise of virtual reality, where we could take somebody on land who maybe can't even swim and put them in a totally immersive experience of this wildlife under our oceans and in our oceans. And have you worked with virtual reality at all? And what do you think about the promise of it?
Yes, I have. Myself and my team, we have produced various sort of, you know, VR features for National Geographic that were published alongside various articles of mine. I think it is a powerful tool, and the science speaks for itself. I mean, there's research being done at reputable institutions and universities that clearly illustrate that exposing people to VR simulations can actually change their you know, their thoughts and their decisions around critical issues. I mean, having an experiential experience that is VR-based versus real can result in the same changes. It can result in the same sort of desire to protect places or to make a difference. So I think VR is a very important tool. I think it is something that is part of the conservation toolbox and that is being used more and more and more impactfully every single year because of the way the technology increases. I think in the past we were hindered by the size of professional VR equipment and being able to get, you know, that equipment into remote places. But these days, you know, it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I see a, you know, a vibrant future for VR that is able to drive, I mean, measurable conservation change. And what's also, I think, great with VR is that, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of tourism, of ecotourism, of sustainable tourism. I want people to experience, you know, the wilderness and the natural places on our world firsthand. But you know what? There are places that are just so sensitive And there are places that I can go as a photographer, and I go for a couple of days, and I am incredibly careful. I am knowledgeable. I'm respectful. I know how to operate in that environment without damaging it. You know, the fact that I can go there and I can make some pictures is one thing, but then to have thousands of tens of thousands of people to follow in my footsteps and to also want to be in that place, you know, that is, you know, for sensitive places, that is simply not an option. There's all these great places that I photograph and I show people and say, isn't this amazing? But you cannot go there. So at the end of the day, I think VR, you know, gives us an opportunity to take people to places that need their love, that I need you to care about this place, but it's so sensitive, you'll never be able to go there. But you know what? We've created a virtual experience for you that is as close to the real thing as possible. And I think that if you experience this, you're going to feel the same amount of love and the same amount of inspiration that I felt when I was actually there in person. So I'm a huge proponent of VR and of any other, you know, future technologies that might help us to get more people, you know, to become part of the solution.
Sure.
And step away from being part of the problem.
Thomas, we only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about an iconic photograph of a marine biologist in a kayak who was very focused on looking forward and where the biologist was taking their kayak. And right behind the kayak is this great white shark who is kind of sneaking up on the biologist. Can you tell us the backstory? And it's an extraordinary photo.
Well, absolutely. Happy to do so. I mean, you know, sharks are largely considered, I mean, less so now than back then, but you know, they have a bit of a PR problem. And, you know, and for many years, I kind of, you know, saw myself as sort of, you know, the shark's PR agent per se. And this was way back in 2003, you know, working on slide film still in South Africa. And I was working on a book that included a chapter on great white sharks. And I was working with these researchers who were, you know, tracking these white sharks. And one day they were, you know, they heard this news about dozens of white sharks. I mean, literally multiple individuals per kilometer of beach. They were all aggregating inshore in shallow water. I mean, you know, 6 feet deep, right inshore. And people were naturally a little bit freaked out of what those sharks were doing there. So the scientists were asked, well, can you figure out what they're doing? And this was no money for aerial surveys. And the problem was the scientists were operating in an engine, in a boat with an engine. And the white sharks were either, you know, scared of the engine and they swam away, or they were attracted to it and trying to bite the engine. So they simply couldn't observe natural behavior. And I had this idea that, hey, you know, why don't we use a sea kayak to track great white sharks? And at the time it seemed perfectly normal and rational. And because it was my, you know, idea, I got to test it out first. So I found myself in this yellow plastic sea kayak and tracking white sharks across this bay. And much to our surprise, you know, the white sharks ignored the kayak. And having a GPS, we were able to track these white sharks in a kayak in a way that they were not disturbed. And we were able to observe their natural behavior in this environment. And once we'd worked out the science, I now wanted to make the ultimate white shark picture. I wanted to show this exciting science. I wanted to show that sharks were not killers. And they were these beautiful, gentle animals. And in my head, I had this picture of this research scientist in this kayak tracking this white shark across this beautiful bay at the southern tip of South Africa. And of course, when I began to make images, we had this one shark that decided to turn the tables on the scientist. And it came up behind the kayak and it rose through the water column. I could see it coming up. And as the dorsal fin broke the surface, you know, I was about to make a picture. I was still on slide film. I was down the last few rolls of last few picks. And I waited. I hesitated for this tiny second. And as I waited, the shark scientist, he turned around. And he perfectly looked at that dorsal fin behind him. I made three frames and that's the picture. At the end of the day, I'd wanted something different, but that image was just significantly more iconic than the other one that was in my head. And it still, in my opinion, illustrates, you know, it's not an aggressive image. It's just this sort of calm and curious way where the white shark's going, what are you doing here? And the scientist looking back going, what are you doing here? So it kind of, you know, it captures a different side to white sharks to what I think, you know, other pictures have done over the decades.
It is an absolutely incredible photograph. Thomas Peshak, a National Geographic photographer, joins us. His new book is Wild Seas, and it is this collection of 200 images and all of these stories. And obviously, Thomas, you are a great storyteller in addition to being a world-class photographer. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.